softest, cleanest clothes I'd ever worn. The kitchen floor gleamed and all the bottles had been removed, the worktops wiped down. There was a pile of folded laundry on one of the chairs. The table was bare save for a vase, the only one I owned, filled with yellow tulips. There was a note propped against it. "Some food in the fridge. Try to drink as much water as you can. Call me when you're up. R. Kiss." He'd scrawled his phone number at the bottom. I sat down and stared at it, and then at the sunshine brightness of the flowers. No one had ever bought me flowers before. I didn't much care for tulips, but he wasn't to know that. I started to cry. Huge, quivering sobs howling like an animal. It felt like I would never stop, like I couldn't stop. Eventually, from sheer physical exhaustion, I was quiet. I rested my forehead on the table. My life, I realised, had gone wrong. Very, very wrong. I wasn't supposed to live like this. No one was supposed to live like this. The problem was that I simply didn't know how to make it right. Mummy's way was wrong, I knew that. But no one had ever shown me the right way to live a life. And although I'd tried my best over the years, I simply didn't know how to make things better. I could not solve the puzzle of me. I made some tea and heated up the ready meal that Raymond had left in the fridge. I was, I discovered, very hungry indeed. I washed the cup and fork afterwards, stacked them beside the other clean crockery he'd left to drain. I went into the living room and picked up the phone. He answered on the second ring.
"Eleanor, thank God," he said. "Pose. How are you feeling?"
"Hello, Raymond," I said.
"How are you?"
he asked again, sounding strained. "Fine, thanks," I said. This was, I knew, the correct answer.
"For fuck's sake, Eleanor! Fine! Oh, Christ!" he said. "I'll be round in an hour, okay?"
"Really, Raymond, there's no need," I said calmly. "I've had some food." I didn't know what time it was and didn't want to risk guessing whether it had been lunch or dinner. "And a shower. And I'm going to read for a while and then have an early night."
"I'll be round in an hour," he said again, firmly, and then hung up.
When I answered the door, he was holding a bottle of iron brew and a bag of jelly babies. I managed a smile. "Come in," I said. I wondered how he'd got in before. Had no recollection of opening the door to him. What had I said? What kind of state had I been in? I felt my heart start to pound, jittery and anxious. Had I sworn at him? Had I been naked? Had something terrible happened between us? I felt the iron brew start to slip from my grasp and it fell on the floor and rolled around. He picked it up, gripped my elbow in his other hand and guided me to the kitchen. He sat me at the table and put the kettle on. I should have been offended that he was commandeering my living space, but instead I felt relief, overwhelming relief at being taken care of. We sat on opposite sides of the table with a cup of tea and said nothing for a while. He spoke first.
"What the fuck, Eleanor?" he said.
I was shocked to hear the wobble in his voice, as though there were tears lurking there. I simply shrugged. He began to look angry.
"Eleanor, you were AWOL from work for 3 days. Bob was really worried about you, we all were. I got your address from him. I came round to see if you're okay and I find you...
"Preparing to kill myself?" I asked. He rubbed his hand across his face and I saw that he was very close to crying.
"Look, I know you're a very private person and that's fine, but we're pals, you know, you can talk to me about stuff. Don't bottle things up."
"Why not?" I asked. "How can telling someone how bad you're feeling make it better? It's not like they can fix it, can they?"
"They probably can't fix everything, Eleanor, no," he said, "but talking can help. Other people have problems too, you know, they understand what it feels like to be unhappy. A problem shared and all that."
"I don't think anyone on earth would understand what it feels like to be me," I said. "That's just a fact. I don't think anyone else has lived through precisely the set of circumstances I've lived through. And survived them, at any rate," I said.
It was an important clarification.
Try me, he said.
He looked at me and I looked at him.
Okay, if not me, then try someone else, a counsellor, a therapist.
I snorted, a most inelegant sound.
A counsellor, I said. Oh, let's sit around and talk about our feelings and that'll magically make everything better.
I don't think so, Raymond. He smiled.
How will you know until you try, though? What have you got to lose? There's no shame, you know, no shame at all in being depressed or having a mental illness or whatever.
I almost choked on my tea.
Mental illness? What are you talking about, Raymond?
I shook my head. He held up both hands in a placatory movement.
Look, I'm not a doctor. It's just, well, I don't think someone who gives themselves alcohol poisoning while they plan their suicide is, you know, in a very good place.
This was such a ridiculous summation of my situation that I almost laughed. Raymond wasn't usually prone to exaggeration, but this was over the top, and I couldn't allow it to stand as a factually accurate description of what had happened that night.
Raymond, I simply had a bit too much vodka after a stressful evening, that's all. It's hardly symptomatic of an illness.
Where had you been that night? He said.
What's been going on since then?
I shrugged. I went to a gig, I said. It wasn't very good. Neither of us spoke for a while.
Eleanor, he said eventually, this is serious. If I hadn't come over when I did, you might be dead by now, either from the booze or from choking on your own vomit. That's if you hadn't already overdosed on the pills or whatever.
I put my head on one side and pondered this.
All right, I said. I concede that I was feeling very unhappy. But doesn't everyone feel sad from time to time?
Yes, of course they do, Eleanor, he said calmly. But when people are feeling sad, they have a little cry, maybe eat too much ice cream, stay in bed all afternoon. What they don't do is think about drinking drain cleaner or opening their veins with a bread knife.
Despite myself, I shuddered at the thought of those sharp, sharp teeth. I shrugged, acquiescing.
Touché, Raymond. I said, I can't counter your reasoning.
He reached out and put his hands on my forearms, squeezed them. He was strong.
Will you think about going to the doctor at least? Wouldn't do any harm, would it?
I nodded. Again, he was being logical and you can't argue with logic.
Is there anyone you want me to get in contact with? He said, a friend, a relative. What about your mum? She'll want to know that you've been feeling like this, won't she?
He stopped speaking because I laughed.
Not mummy, I said, shaking my head. She'd probably be absolutely delighted.
Raymond looked horrified.
Come on, Eleanor, that's a terrible thing to say, he said, visibly shocked. No one's mother would be happy to know their child was suffering.
I shrugged and kept my eyes focused on the floor. You haven't met Mummy, I said.
Chapter 28. The next few days were somewhat challenging. On several occasions, Raymond arrived unannounced, ostensibly to bring comestibles or relay messages from Bob, but in fact to check that I hadn't committed an act of self-slaughter. If I were to compose a concise crossword clue to describe Raymond's demeanour, it would be the opposite of inscrutable. I could only hope that the man refrained from playing poker on all but the most casual basis, as I feared he'd be leaving the table with an empty wallet. It was surprising that he should bother with me, especially given the unpleasant circumstances in which he'd found me after the concert. Whenever I'd been sad or upset before, the relevant people in my life would simply call my social worker and I'd be moved somewhere else. Raymond hadn't phoned anyone or asked an outside agency to intervene. He'd elected to look after me himself. I'd been pondering this and concluded that there must be some people for whom difficult behaviour wasn't a reason to end their relationship with you. If they liked you, and I remembered Raymond and I had agreed that we were pals now, then it seemed they were prepared to maintain contact, even if you were sad or upset or behaving in very challenging ways.
This was something of a revelation. I wondered if that's what it would be like in a family, if you had parents or a sister, say, who would be there no matter what. It wasn't that you could take them for granted as such. Heaven knows, nothing can be taken for granted in this life. It was simply that you would know, almost unthinkingly, that they'd be there if you needed them, no matter how bad things got. I'm not prone to envy, as a rule, but I must confess I felt a twinge when I thought about this. Envy was a minor emotion, however, in comparison to the sorrow I felt at never having a chance to experience this, what was it? Unconditional love, I supposed. But there was no use in crying over spilt milk. Raymond had shown me a little of what it must be like, and I counted myself lucky to have had the opportunity. Today he'd arrived with a box of after-eight mints and, improbably, a helium-filled balloon.
"I know it's daft," he said, smiling, "but I was passing the market in the square and I saw a guy selling these when I was going for my bus. Thought it might cheer you up."
I saw what he was holding and I laughed. An unexpected burst of feeling, unfamiliar. He passed me the ribbon and the balloon soared towards my low ceiling, then bobbed against it, as though it was trying to escape.
"What is it supposed to be?" I said. Is it cheese?"
I had never been given a helium balloon before, and certainly not one this odd-looking.
"It's SpongeBob, Eleanor," he said, speaking very slowly and clearly as though I was some sort of idiot. "SpongeBob SquarePants?"
A semi-human bath sponge with protruding front teeth, on sale as if it was something completely unremarkable. For my entire life, people have said that I'm strange, but really, when I see things like this, I realise that I'm actually relatively normal. I made tea for us. Raymond had put his feet up on the coffee table. I was considering asking him to remove them, but then the thought came to me that he must feel at home in my house, comfortable enough to relax here and make full use of the furniture. The idea was actually rather pleasing. He slurped his tea, a much less pleasant intrusion, and asked about the GP. Earlier in the week, after Raymond had delivered a persuasive argument about the importance of obtaining an expert, objective view of my emotional state, and of the efficacy of modern treatments should any mental health issues be diagnosed, I'd finally agreed to make an appointment at the surgery. "I'm going tomorrow," I said, 11:30. He nodded.
"That's good, Eleanor," he said. "Now promise me you'll be completely honest with the doctor. Tell her exactly what you've been feeling, what you've been going through."
I thought about this. I would tell her almost everything, I decided, but I wasn't going to mention the little stockpile of pills, which no longer existed in any case. Raymond had, with scant concern for the environment, flushed them down the lavatory. I'd professed irritation, but was secretly glad to be rid of them. And I'd also decided to say nothing about the chats with Mummy or our ridiculous abortive project. Mummy always said that information should be divulged to professional busybodies on a need-to-know basis, and these topics weren't relevant. All the doctor needed to understand was that I was very unhappy, so that she could advise me how best to go about changing that. We didn't need to start digging around in the past, talking about things that couldn't be changed. "Promise," I said. I had my fingers crossed, though. Chapter 29. When the GP signed me off work, I wondered how a life of indolence would suit me. I've always had a full-time job, having started with Bob the week after I received my degree, and in all the years since then I've never once had cause to call in sick. Fortunately, I've been blessed with an extremely robust constitution. The first week, the week immediately after the incident with the vodka and the visit from Raymond, I slept a lot. I must have done other things, normal things too, like going out to buy milk or having a shower, but I can't recall them now. The doctor had somehow managed to deduce that I was suffering from depression, even with only a few scant details to go on. I managed to keep all of my most important secrets to myself.
She suggested that medication and talking therapy combined was the most effective form of treatment, but I insisted that I did not wish to take any tablets, at least initially. I was worried that I might start to rely on them in the same way that I'd been relying on vodka. I did, however, reluctantly agree to see a counsellor as a first step, and the inaugural session had been scheduled for today. I had been assigned to a Maria Temple, no title provided. I cared nothing for her marital status, but it would have been helpful to know in advance whether or not she was in possession of any formal medical qualifications. Her office was located on the third floor of a tall, modern block in the city centre. The lift had transported me back in time to that least belle of époque, the 1980s. Grey, grey, grey. Sludgy pastels, dirty plastic, nasty carpets. It smelled like it hadn't been cleaned since the 1980s either. I had been reluctant to attend the counselling session from the outset, and to do so in this setting made it even less enticing, if such a thing were possible. Sadly, the environment was all too familiar, and this was, in its own way, a comfort. The institutional corridors with floral friezes and artex ceilings down which I have walked in my life are legion. I knocked on the door. Thin plywood, grey, no nameplate. And, too quickly, as though she had been standing right behind it, Maria Temple opened it and invited me in. The room was tiny. A dining chair and two institutional armchairs, the wipe clean, uncomfortable kind, arranged opposite a small, low table, on which was placed a box of non-branded, man-sized tissues. I was momentarily thrown. Their noses are, with a few exceptions, more or less the same size as our own, are they not? Did they really need a vastly bigger surface area of tissue simply because they were in possession of an XY chromosome? Why? I suspected that I really did not want to know the answer to that question. There was no window, and a framed print on the wall, a vase of roses made using a computer by someone who was dead inside, was more offensive to the eye than a bare wall. "You must be Eleanor," she said, smiling. "It's Miss Oliphant, actually," I said, taking off my jerkin and wondering what on earth to do with it. She pointed to a row of hooks on the back of the door where I placed it as far away as possible from the very practical waterproof which hung there already. I sat down opposite her. The chair released a tired whump of stale air from its grubby cushions. She smiled at me. Her teeth! Oh, Ms. Temple, she had done her best, but nothing could change the size of them, I supposed. They belonged in a far bigger mouth, perhaps not even a human one. I was reminded of a photograph that the Telegraph had featured some time ago, of a monkey which had grabbed a camera and taken its own grinning photograph, a selfie. The poor woman. An adjective which one would never wish to have applied to one's teeth was simian. "I'm Maria Temple, Eleanor, Miss Oliphant," she said. "It's a pleasure to meet you." She looked intently at me, which made me sit forward in my seat, not wanting to show how uncomfortable I was feeling. "Have you ever had counselling before, Miss Oliphant?" she said, taking out a notebook from her handbag. It had, I noticed, several accessories attached to it, key rings and the like. A pink, fluffy monkey, a giant metallic letter M, and, most hideous of all, a tiny sequined red stiletto shoe. I'd come across the type before. Ms. Temple was fun. "Yes and no," I said. She raised a quizzical eyebrow, but I declined to elaborate further. There was a silence, in which I heard the lift clattering again, although no further sound or evidence of human occupation followed. I felt marooned. "Okay, then," she said brightly, too brightly. "I think we'll get started. Now, first of all, I want to reassure you that everything we discuss in here together is absolutely confidential. I'm a member of all the relevant professional bodies, and we adhere to a very strict code of conduct. You should always feel comfortable and safe in this space, and please ask me anything at any time, especially if you're not clear about what we're doing or why." She seemed to be waiting for some sort of response, but I had none to offer her. I shrugged.